All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey everyone, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background, and you guys are in for a treat. We have been doing a ton of podcast interviews lately. We've been just doing a ton of podcasts lately. We have a whole bunch of new shows that aren't even affiliated with this one, really. We are about to unleash upon you all, but today on the show that you are listening to, I am talking to the incredible guitarist and singer-songwriter Ariel Posen, who happens to have a brand new record out right now called Headway, and it is incredible. It's soulful. Playing is incredible. Encourage you all to check it out. Ariel is a force of nature. One of the great guitarists, one of the great slide guitarists of the world, and he somehow also can craft a song, which is not fair to the rest of us, but he's got it all. He's the real deal. You probably saw him in the Brothers Landreth, or maybe you've seen him. He's been here at the Fretboard Journal back in the day. Ariel's great. I want you to check out the record Headway, and as an added bonus, when I was talking to Ariel about this podcast interview, I convinced him to teach you all a little guitar lesson. So on fretboardjournal.com, Ariel's got a little lesson just for you. So please go check that out. Around here at the Seattle headquarters of the Fretboard Journal, we are busy mailing our brand new issue, Fretboard Journal 47. James Taylor is on the cover of that issue. If you are an existing subscriber, your copy is en route to you. They are working their way across the globe. I know many folks on the west side of the Mississippi have already seen their copies. For the rest of you, you're going to probably get your copies next week. And I hope you love it. It's one of my favorite issues. Ariel is from Canada. We have some Canadian coverage in this issue. Bahamas, one of my favorite bands of the moment, is in this issue, as well as a gorgeous, it brought a tear to my eye. I said that, and I was not exaggerating. David Wren wrote a beautiful piece about 50 years of guitar making, the ups and downs and trials and tribulations of following your passion. I love that story. I want more stories like that in every issue of the Fretboard Journal. It's beautiful stuff. So please check that out if you haven't yet, and thank you for your support of our quirky little magazine and all the different projects that we do. Speaking of support, shout out to Folkway Music up in Canada, as well as Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in New York City, as well as Mono Cases, which can be found everywhere. All three of those brands are supporting us in a big way and allowing us to do this podcast. So as you probably all know, the New York Times even just wrote about this, podcasting continues to blow up, and we are expanding our family of podcasts. So if you do not know, let me just give you the rundown here because it's kind of confusing. The Fretboard Journal podcast, the podcast you're listening to, has been around for about a decade. I've been at this for a long time. We interview all the folks you would read about in the Fretboard Journal magazine, builders, players, collectors, you name it. This is the podcast that started it all. Thank you for tuning in. We also have Luthier on Luthier, where Michael Bashkin interviews fellow guitar makers once a month. It is a great listen, even if you are not a guitar maker. I learn a lot from every episode of that show. We also have The Truth About Vintage Amps, a show that I co-host. Amp Tech Skip Simmons fields all your questions, kind of car talk style, about vintage amplifiers, fixing them up, restoring them, modding them. It's hilarious. It's informative. It has its own cult following that has exceeded my expectations. That comes out every 2 weeks. And then we just launched on the alternate weeks, when that one's not happening, The Truth About Recording and Mixing. That is by Johnny Sangster. Similar format. You send in questions, Johnny and experts answer them on all things recording, mixing, and mastering. And last but not least, we have a couple of other podcasts in the works. I am the host of Acoustic Voices, a podcast for Breedlove guitars. Check that out if you are a Breedlove fanatic or just want to hear about some of the people behind an acoustic guitar brand. It's pretty fascinating to do that. We have a new podcast launching next week called Diddy Wah Diddy. That is hosted by John Tavius Willis, who is one of the greatest blues players you will ever hear. If you have not checked out his Robert Johnson Challenge on YouTube, you must. John Tavius was a former guest on this podcast, and when he told me that one of his hobbies was interviewing his blues heroes, I knew it should be a podcast. So our first episode features John Tavius interviewing Taj Mahal. We have a bunch of fun surprises in store for that one. It is a very fun listen. If you are at all into the blues, you need to check it out. And then last but not least, I just launched a side hustle project. It's not even a side hustle. I don't make any money off of it. It's called Sweep the Floor. And the idea there is I've had such a blast interviewing guitar makers about their craft. I want to interview people who don't build guitars about their craft. So I'm going to be interviewing mechanics, bicycle frame makers, boot makers. Who knows who I'm going to be interviewing? I'm going to be interviewing people who work with their hands and build stuff that is meant to last every couple of weeks. And that's called Sweep the Floor. So check that out. That's coming very soon as well. But task at hand right now, listen to Ariel Posen and then go listen to Headway, his new record, because it is fantastic. And again, thank you for tuning in to all the things we do here at the Fretboard Journal. Audio, paper-based, digitally. I appreciate the heck out of it. In 2021, it is so cool to know we have so many fans who are interested in great music and great storytelling. It really keeps us going. Thanks for your support. Here is my chat with Ariel Posen. Thank you, Ariel, for talking to me. I hate to say this because I'm tired of talking about the pandemic, but I feel like every record that comes out between now and 2 years from now, the pandemic will be some sort of milestone as to how the record got made or maybe something that inspired the record. When did Headway actually start to, you know, become a thing?
Well, we actually got started right before, still at that point where we had no idea this was going to happen to us. Yeah, we got the band together and we hit the studio at the beginning of December 2019. I had just wrapped up a bunch of touring overseas and in Canada. And it was a perfect time, you know. We laid out a plan, record all of December, maybe start mixing early March because I was on tour right after NAMM. I had a 3-week tour in the UK and about a 2-week tour in Sweden. And one last show in Canada, and then I was going to take a couple months off, and we were going to start mixing the record. And that all happened the exact same way. It just so happened that when we started mixing, the world shut down too, which wasn't the worst thing in the world. It just delayed the entire process of the release. But the actual creative part of the record, recording in the studio, production, pre-production, all that stuff was done before, which I'm grateful for, that we didn't have anything clouding the vibe. You know, it was just another normal time in life that in some ways we all took for granted and enjoyed.
and what was the vibe you were going for with this record? What was the inspiration?
Well, it was really just continuing where I left off with the first record. The first one, it's hard to say. I mean, I was getting to know myself as an artist. My whole life, I've been a guitar player for people and for artists and for bands. And the first record was all about, hey, this is me. I'm out here trying to find my voice as an artist. I feel like I had my voice as a guitarist already, but as an artist, I feel like you need to put one down and say, here I am. Let's grow from here. And once I put that first record out, I put a lot of more miles on my belt. I was touring very hard and I was writing a lot more. So that first record, I had 8 songs. I recorded 7 of them. This album, I had 20 songs and I recorded 12 of them. You know, so I had just a lot more time. I just had a lot more, in some ways, I don't want to use the word confidence, but just I was just more sure of myself and the process. So, I wasn't questioning everything. I was used to the idea of being the guy making all the decisions artistically, creatively, all like in every aspect of it. So it was just the vibe of this record, and the whole point was, and you know, one of the many themes that has headway attached to it was just evolving and just continuing where I left off, but growing, same path, same me. It's like, I feel like these songs still could be a step off point from how long. It's just, you put another year and a half of touring and life experience and stuff like that, you're gonna have a different outlook on the creative side and your own life, and that all feeds its way into the music of it itself.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned touring, and you tour all over the place. When does your songwriting come to be? Does it come on those road trips, or does it come at home, or all over the place?
Yeah, I cannot write on the road. Like, it's one thing if you have a day off and management says, hey, I set up a session for you to write with this person. And it's like, oh, that would be such a great opportunity. I'm exhausted and I really just want to do nothing, but I'm going to take you up on that and do that. With the exception of that, I don't even have the mental capacity to write on the road. I'm not only am I just playing every night, but I'm acting as tour manager. I'm booking hotels. I'm booking car rental, whatever it is, flights for everybody. I got to do merch. I'm settling up show. I'm literally doing everything. The last thing I'm going to do is write a song. That being said, you know, a little idea always pops up, maybe in a sound check, even on a gig. You never know. Just like little ideas formulate. And I'll always put those down on my iPhone. But when I actually sit down and write, it has to be off time. It has to be when I'm at home. That's where I can actually focus on it. And I think it's different for everybody. And there's no right or wrong way. I know a lot of people that can write on the road easily, and writing comes so natural to them. And it does come natural to me, but I have to be in that right headspace where I'm not thinking about a million things and I'm actively not doing a million things. I just need to be in one place with an instrument, with a lyric, the melody, and just commit to it there. So as much time as I was on the road, I had just as much time at home, and really just tried to make the most of that time, not traveling, to like use it with writing. Mm-hmm.
So have you been able to write your next album during this pandemic while you figure out what to do with this one?
Actually, yeah, 100%. But funny enough, it took me a long time. You know, pandemic started early March 2020. I honestly didn't feel inspired or creative until end of September. And I think a big reason was, you know, I was wrapping up mixing and mastering and every single detail for Headway for those first few months. But also, I just wasn't feeling creatively inspired. I was fortunate to work. I've been able to still work playing guitar and as an artist, just without playing concerts. I'm so grateful for that. But from a creative standpoint, I just wasn't feeling it until around late September. And I think a big reason for that was, you know, we put out music and we write music so that we can share it with the world. Even though we write for ourselves, so much of that is sharing it and like getting to perform it. And to me personally, like, it's not the full experience just to, here you go, it's on the internet now, it's on YouTube, it's on Spotify, Apple Music, whatever. It's kind of only half of the experience. So I think those first few months, and I can speak on behalf of a bunch of friends and colleagues of mine who are all in the same boat, is like there was a lot of joy missing from that aspect that also led to like, what's the point of creating right now if we can't? So I eventually fizzled out and the bug hit me. And yeah, since the end of September, even till now, I've kind of slowed down just because I've been so busy with the lead up to this album release. I have been writing a lot for the next record, for sure. And I'm very excited about it. It's been an experience to, like, I like to do a lot of co-writing with people, and I have some people that often I like to write with. And we've always either, if we couldn't do it in person, we would do it over Skype or FaceTime. I was doing that for years already because a lot of my time I was overseas in Ireland or I was somewhere else. Doing all these Zoom writes, honestly, is fine for me. It's the same as it was, and it kind of cuts off the, what time zone are you in? We're not in the same city. We can't meet. Like, that has disappeared. That is quite the advantage. It is exhausting sitting in front of a screen all day, you know, talking to people and being on a camera, but it's never been easier to connect with these with those people wherever they are, overseas, Canada, US, Europe, wherever. Like, it's pretty amazing in that regard.
Since you are an expert at this, I got to ask, when you do these Zoom co-writes, is there a process? Is there a procedure you always go through, or are all of them different depending on the personalities of who you're talking to?
A little of both. Everyone's got their own way. But at the same time, I kind of just write. When I write with somebody else, it's like they're people that I've been writing with for a while, and they know how I work. I know how they work. So it is kind of a similar process. I'll usually bring an idea. This I will say, specifically writing for my material, I need to bring an idea, or else if we're just starting from scratch and coming up with something on the fly, I won't necessarily feel like it's fully me unless I'm bringing the idea, whether it just be a musical thing or a lyric. I don't know why that is. It's just how it feels. I can't quite explain it. But yeah, once the idea is brought to the table, we just kind of attack it like we would in any other room in person. And, you know, the only thing is that you can't play at the same time with each other, but it's honestly not something it really doesn't take away from the experience. At the end of the day, if you can write a good song, that's all that matters. And I think it is very doable still. And everyone gets to sit in their pajamas.
What you said, you've been pretty busy this whole year. What any projects that weren't yours that we should know about?
Well, I've other than just like putting out my own music, I'm grateful to like be involved in a lot of like courses and master classes, kind of as an educator. I don't consider myself an actual teacher. You know, I'll do Skype or Zoom lessons off my social media, and say once every 2 months, I'll say, hey, everybody, I'm going to do lessons for 2 weeks only. Get in while you can, kind of thing. And I enjoy that because those lessons are strictly what I do. And no one's showing up asking how to play Enter Sandman or anything like that. But other than that, yeah, I've been doing a lot of just recording sessions and producing. So I'm fully set up. I have my own little studio here. So a lot of people have been sending me tracks to play on their records, play on their singles, whatever. I recently just did, well, the first single of his came out last Friday, but I produced a record for a really nice fella named Colin Fowley. He's from Fredericton on the east coast of Canada, and lovely, lovely singer-songwriter, beautiful, beautiful songwriter and singer. Basically just said the same thing twice. Cool. And because of the situation and whatnot, you have to quarantine if you do any traveling between Canada, like provinces. So what happened was I had him fly to Winnipeg, and I flew to Winnipeg, and we both individually quarantined for 2 weeks. And
wow.
Then, yeah, we did the full process, but we recorded his full bed track, so bass and drums, his vocals, acoustics, and I did some piano and some other stuff all together. And then he flew back, I flew back, and I did the rest of this record. I did all the electric guitars, all the background vocals here in my studio with him on Zoom, just kind of watching along. I wanted to keep him in the loop just in case he had any ideas or didn't like anything. And then I sourced out, you know, some pedal steel tracks, some B3 tracks from some friends of mine, which is just the norm now. Everyone's got a studio set up and everyone is recording from home. And it's kind of amazing that on a dime, you can call friends or like sometimes even heroes that happen to just dig what you do and you love what they do, and they're like, they want to work, they want to create, and you say, hey, can you throw something down on this track? And they're like, yeah, of course, I'd love to. It's like, this is crazy, you know? It's never been easier. So we did this record primarily remotely, and yeah, I really suggest checking it out if you like the Americana rootsy singer-songwriter thing. Colin Fowley, first single cool. Came out last week. Really, really nice stuff. I'm happy with how it turned out.
Well, I want to get more back into Headway, but before we get into that, what is your home recording setup? Because you bounce around the world all the time. It must be fairly mobile.
It is fairly mobile. I have certain elements that I could actually travel. I have taken stuff with me on the road. In terms of the actual setup, it is pretty simple. I mean, I have a Universal Audio interface where I can record vocals, anything acoustic, anything electric. My room could be treated a bit better, but I truly believe that if I can get just a decent sound on its own, then whoever's mixing it can make it sound amazing after. And electric guitars, I got a fine collection of guitars and amps with me. I, however, am in a situation where I can't really turn stuff up. So if it really calls for like needing to put a microphone on an amp and crank and like get that experience, I will happily go to a studio. But for 98% of the time, I can record through the aux, which is absolutely amazing. I have this other amp. It's actually built in Winnipeg, the Rev D20, which has the Two Notes Torpedo built in, which is also kind of like the aux. It's an attenuator, but also a cabinet simulator. I don't use any attenuation, but the cabinet simulation stuff, I don't think it's ever been better. It's never been closer, because it's still the amp. You still get all the characteristics of the actual amp rather than the processed sound. I have nothing against the Kempers and all that kind of stuff. I just find there's really a loss in dynamics and just the touch sensitivity and the personal relationship you have with an amp. It's missing in those processors. So at least using the aux or something, you still have all those elements.
Yeah, those auxes are pretty aux-in, I guess. They're pretty damn cool.
They're great. Very great.
And what is your go-to amp right now for most of your recordings?
For most of my recordings and for playing live, I've been using the Two Rock stuff for the last few years. I do a lot of, for my stuff and for live, I'll usually take guitars out that are tuned down lower, and often sometimes I capo up higher. So I don't have the luxury of traveling with 10 guitars or 5 guitars. I can take 2 with me easily. So if I tune those down lower, it just gives me more real estate of range. So I need that headroom. I need loudness. I just need something that can hold the weight against it. And those Two Rocks, I always say it's good loud. You know, like you turn up a twin reverb and it's like harsh loud.
Uh-huh.
Two Rocks are good loud. You plug into a 100-watt head or amp, whatever, and you don't even realize it's 100 watts because it feels right. It feels only like it's a 50-watt amp. And it has that headroom. It has all that, those dynamics and like the mid-range that I like, and everything about it is exactly. And I've loved those amps from afar. I remember when I first, you know, saw John Mayer playing them like 15 years ago. I was like, oh my God. I've also been a fan of like Stevie Ray Vaughan and Robin Ford playing through those Dumble style amps. And I always thought that sound was so mystical. There was something magical about that. So I always kind of loved that sound, that clean platform, and you put anything over that. That being said, for recording as well, smaller amps can be very fantastic too. I have a couple vintage Fenders, like a 64 Deluxe Reverb and a 1960 Concert, which is not a quiet amp, a 1961 Gibson GA18, one of those tiny guys. So little amps like that are fantastic for recording as well, just for the sake of different colors. Yeah, they'll compress differently and they'll compress quicker than something like the Two Rock, but depending on the part, depending on the song, depending on the situation, it really depends. It really varies. So I don't like block myself away from any other options. I'm open to anything. but I know what I like and what works well for me. Like, for example, a Vox, some of the best amps ever. When I plug into a Vox style amp, I sound like shit. It just doesn't agree with the way I play. I've tried a million times. Some of my favorite players use Voxes. I love how it sounds when they play it. I just can't get that sound. So I just don't use those kind of amps. I just know that the Fender-y type of thing works for me.
Yeah. I don't even know. Like, you know, you mentioned John Mayer, you mentioned the Dumbletone. When you were growing up, how did all this start? Was there an entry point? Was it John Mayer or was it Derek Trucks or someone that kind of led you down this path of the kind of music that you've been playing?
Yeah, but it took a while. It was kind of an unorthodox upbringing because I first got attracted to guitar from the Beatles, and being a mid-90s 8 or 9 year old, Green Day, Nirvana, Chili Peppers, Rage Against the Machine, Soundgarden, I'm forgetting a bunch of other, like that kind of heavy alternative rock and grunge scene, that was the most popular thing at that time. That is what I saw as guitar playing, was like, that's what I want to do. That's why I want to play guitar. Guitar, part of an ensemble. That is what's speaking to me. And then when I was about 16, 17, that's when I heard Stevie Ray Vaughan for the first time. And suddenly I was transformed. I was like, I have so much work to do. I love this kind of playing. And then I got into every style of music, jazz, country, folk, pop, rock, blues, anything I could get my hands on. And then not just guitar players, but piano players, horn players, bass players, everything. And then, so it was like kind of three tiers. It was that, and then it was hearing Stevie and those guys and everything else. But then in my early 20s, I had started just playing slide more on gigs as a hired gun. And people would always, you know, say, hey, that actually sounded really nice how you did it, how you played that part. Why don't you just do that on more of the songs that don't have slide? I said, okay, sure. And I did see Derek Trucks. I remember seeing him for the first time in 2006, and it was an absolutely moving experience. It was like, oh my God, I've never seen such musical and lyrical playing like that. But it didn't speak to me in a way like that I need to do that. I actually, you know, there's a lot of great slide players I was a fan of already. First of all, the Beatles, George Harrison, some of the tastiest use of slide ever. And then, you know, you got your like Bonnie Raitt and Racooter. Like there's a small handful of amazing players that I associated with slide. And then I heard Kevin Bright from Toronto.
Yeah.
And that is when everything changed for me. That was when I had my first moment of, okay, now that is slide being used in a way that speaks to me. You know, use of some droning, some chordal stuff, some behind the slides. Everything about it was not blues playing and not the standard way of playing slide, which is nothing wrong with that. I know a lot of people put on a slide and treat it like it's kind of a niche or a novelty. I heard him play and it was like that right there moved me so hard. Like I've never been moved more by just music in general. That is what's speaking to me. And it's not like I want to sound like that, but that approach inspired me to take slide way more seriously and get into it and, you know, start exploring open tunings. So at that point, I grabbed a guitar that I had and tuned it to open E and started taking it on every gig I had. So I would just try to play what I was already doing in open E and trial by fire, just starting to understand the differences between the tunings and how to play the same thing on either guitar. So they were almost like two different instruments. And yeah.
I don't even know. Have you and Kevin, like, are you friends?
Yeah. Yeah. We're acquaintances. We're pals. I hired him to do a session a couple of years ago for an album that I was producing. It was a very funny experience. There was just this one song. I did the solo and I just really wasn't digging it. And I'm not afraid to fire myself, you know? So I fired my own solo, and I called Kevin, and I kind of talked him up to the artist and the engineer, and I was like, guys, you're not gonna regret this. This is gonna change, you know, like, I'll pay for it, take it out of my fee, it's all good. And it was such a treat. And then, yeah, I mean, I'd say we're acquaintances.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking you guys need to interview each other for the Fretboard Journal.
Oh my God, that'd be fun.
I just interviewed him for the Fretboard Journal podcast, like when the latest mandolin epic 5 album thing came out. I'm sure you've heard it, but yeah.
He is just the ultimate musician's musician. And there wasn't just the slide playing that spoke to me. As a sideman and a hired gun, it was so inspiring seeing someone so proficient as a guitar player also be so proficient, you know, on a resonator, on a dobro, on a mandolin, on a banjo. And I put heavy amounts of time into all those records, like the banjo record, the dobro record, the mandolin records, the Folk Alarm stuff, Sisters Euclid, the stuff with Harry Mang, everything. I just, such a huge fan.
What, for that one song that you fired yourself on, what did he bring to the table that you didn't, or where did he go with it that you're like, God, I could have, maybe you could have done that, or maybe you couldn't have. I just want to hear you talk about it.
Yeah, I think I was a co-writer on the song, and I try to just serve the song. I'm trying to do nothing more, nothing less than the right thing. But the right thing, and it wasn't that it was bad. Like, I think it was a fine solo. It just wasn't. It wasn't enough. It was an emotional song. It was the title track of the record, and I just wanted it to be special and kind of in your face, balls to the wall, you know. And I tried a bunch of things. I think I was just being too polite with it, and I just wanted someone with ears that had no experience with the song to just jump in the way they're hearing it with fresh ears, and kind of like driving with the brakes not working on your car and no seatbelt. And that was what Kevin brought to it. He didn't ask what approach I wanted. Oh, I think I told him just like do a slide. Give me a slide solo. And he probably gave me 4 or 5 options. And yeah, the end result was just, it was very him. It was just very manic and like all over the map, but in the most beautiful way. And the way it built, it started somewhere that had a little story arc to it. It was, and like, I couldn't even tell you how to play it. It's so him and so creative and so out there. And I'm sure he couldn't play it the same way. I mean, I feel like he's one of those guys that there's certain players out there who you play something in one way and then you could just never do it the same way again, because you're always chasing something else. You always got another idea in your head. You've got so many musical ideas circulating in your head that you got to chase each one. You can't just stay on the same one. I'm just assuming. But that's how it seemed getting tracks from him. It was really wonderful.
That's the famous quote from Jackson Browne about David Lindley. It was the running on empty solo. He is never able to repeat it after he did it that one time that everybody knows.
Exactly. There you go. That's exactly it.
You talking about this is a perfect segue to the bulk of my questions about Headway, which is, you know, you talk about serving the song. And when I first listened to this record, the songs really were at the forefront. You really, and I guess where I'm going with this is, you're known for these fiery live shows. I mean, your solos are world famous and on YouTube for, you know, being these amazing, ridiculous guitar solos that no one else can pull off. Talk to me about restraint and figuring out the editing process of like, how much guitar is too much, how much, you know, does the solo go too far and distract from the song? I just want to hear your thought process.
Yeah. I would be a liar if I said that guitar isn't the focus. You know, guitar is the tool that I use to get all my musical ideas out. It's the sole texture of my music, for sure. However, I do not want to make guitar music. And I don't want to put out songs that are just vehicles to get to a solo section. I think of an album and a live show as two completely different things. And there's a lot of artists out there who are incredible musicians, not just guitar players, but you listen to their record and it's about the song, it's about the lyrics, it's about the arrangement and the dynamics and the textures. And then you go see them live and it's still about that stuff, all that same stuff, except it's a little bit more about stretching out too and catering to the live side of music, which is so exciting. And that's what I'm going for. You know, stretching out and improvising and just playing is my upbringing. That's how I cut my teeth. Other than playing gigs as a hired gun for people, I'd play three sets a night every night of the week with my band or other bands, playing covers, playing other songs, just like shedding on stage, improvising, stretching out, taking arrangements to different places. That's who I am. That's what I do. So as much as I love doing that, it's not something that necessarily comes across on a record. And I like to respect the songs themselves without feeling like I need to put that in. Like, I'm not trying to make a statement. I'm not trying to say like, hey, look at me, look at the guitar playing, I just want to put out songs. I like listening to songs that are meaningful, that I can sing along to, that I can maybe sing along to the solo. Like, I spend way more time coming up with a memorable solo that lasts two bars than I would with stretching out. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of attention that goes into the parts, the sounds, the playing. I produced this last record with Murray Pulver, who produced my first record. And yeah, we spent days getting sounds, getting parts, finding the right thing. And I should say, with all these songs, like, whenever I've written a song, I will do a full demo at home. Like, I will essentially record it, you know, kind of in a mock-up way, so I have an idea of how it's sitting. And once we actually hit the studio, I can give it to the band and say, here's the vibe so far, we'll start from here, which helps a lot. But it also helps me craft out the parts as a starting point. And yeah, man, it's just about playing what's only necessary. If you think about it, when you listen to music and you think about your favorite songs, there's typically one or two things that stick with you that you'll always associate a song with, whether it be like, this is just a random example, but like Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. I feel like there's three things that everyone remembers. It's the intro riff, you know, and then they think of the huge drum fill, right? And then they think of right before the verse starts, when the bass is playing the chords, just those two notes. And those have so much more impact than thinking about any. It's all about those kind of moments for me. One little thing here or there, like little candy, little treats, but not taking away from the song itself, not making these songs for those moments, just adding those moments to the song. And I hope that makes sense, but that's kind of my approach with it. It's just what I like to listen to. And, you know, I like people to let those songs sink in and marinate so that when they come to a show, first of all, they expect to hear the song. They expect to maybe know sing along to the lyrics. But other than the parts that they expect and know and are familiar with, I can give them something more. We can stretch out. We can do a reprise at the end and tag this last section and just stretch out on it. And people really like that because they want to see some playing too. And I want to play. So it's a mixture of both live. That's actually a big reason why I did Familiar Ground, which is a live record in the same studio that we did all my records in, just in front of a little audience, because it was a chance to kind of show how I would stretch out on those songs and put in Angeline, which is like kind of become a staple cover that I do, which wouldn't translate as a studio version. It kind of has to be a live performance. So that's where it was all at for.
Yeah, no, that was a fascinating case study to be able to A/B those songs. Is there gear that you take into the studio that you would never take out on the road and vice versa?
In terms of electric stuff, everything I use is exactly what I would use live. And a big reason is that I want to be able to replicate any and all of the sounds and vibes So, I mean, I'll have a couple guitars in just like different tunings, but all those tunings, the only difference between them are the keys that they're in. They're all the same intervals, just different keys. Mm-hmm. When I'm live, I can actually just do all that with a capo on those guitars. I'll always use a two rock generally. The thing that is different is when it comes to acoustics, actually, because recording acoustics on an album for me, it's not about specifically, I need to have my D28 or I need to have my Collings or something. It's actually just about character for acoustics. We need to have a high strung or like a Nashville tuned guitar. We need to have, you know, it's nice to have like a nylon string just in case. It's nice to have maybe a Gibson style thing, a Dreadnought, an OM. Anything that sounds great, anything that sounds kind of crappy but good, as much variety in the acoustic realm is really important to me because that brings such different sonic elements to the songs themselves, as opposed to the electrics, which are like, these are what I use live. This is my comfort zone. This is how I get my sound. This is what I need to have. Everything else is kind of like, yeah, let's just use whatever's around here. Not as precious about it. If it sounds good, great. If it doesn't sound great, I'll find a way to make it sound good, or at least give it some character.
Yeah. Well, what gear was on this record? Might as well get the rundown.
Yeah. Well, I used the two rock, I think 99% of the time. There's one song called It's You, which the main guitar is my Mule resonator, like the actual resonator with a microphone on it and all that stuff. But I'm plugged into a Victory V40. And so you're hearing a mic'd up resonator, but also going through the amp, which is also going through this big tremolo and reverb unit I have, a Victoria Reverberato. So that was the only amp other than the Turok that was used. For the acoustics, I didn't use any of my own. I used stuff at the studio. So Murray, my co-producer, has this beautiful Larrivée. I don't know the model, but he brought it. I used it on How Long as well. Beautiful guitar. Paul at the studio has got a nice collection of stuff. He's got a high strung. Couldn't tell you what it was. I'll get a lot more detailed for the electrics, but he has this beautiful Morgan that he's had since I've known him. Maybe my favorite recording guitar of his. That is like one of the main ones you hear. And I like to do generally like some of the big rocker songs, like Did You See It Coming or Big Picture, or you know, anything that lends itself to strumming guitars. I love to do a big, or Now I See. I like to pan them left and right and have two different guitars, which is a very common practice. It's not like that's my own thing. Everyone kind of does that. So something like the Morgan and the Larrivée together is a magical sound. He's got a couple other ones that I'm completely blanking on. Just some random acoustic guitars. For electrics, though, specifically for the record, I use my Mule, Strato Mule a lot, which is the kind of Strat style electric guitar version of the resonator. Mm-hmm. I have a master built Jazzmaster from Fender that's absolutely amazing. I had never really put time into Jazzmasters before 2.5 years ago, and it kind of changed everything for me. I was always a Strat guy, still am. And the Jazzmaster is maybe one of the most musical instruments I've ever played, just in terms of guitars and the different sounds you can get and the dynamics that comes out of it. I don't know if it's just a good one, but that one's all over it. It's absolutely amazing. My Josh Williams Mockingbird, which is a beautiful 335 style guitar with Ron Ellis pickups, is also all over it. Kind of a rock machine, but can also be very sensitive and beautiful, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I was using my Collings Soco Deluxe, which is slightly smaller body than a 335, single cut. I actually have flat wounds on it, and it's just kind of a different vibe. PAF style, like throwback pickups on it, very much in the same wheelhouse as the Josh Williams, but very different with the flat wounds. And I have this, I used a Case guitar, which is built by my friend John Case out in the UK. He builds beautiful electrics. This one called the J1. The Case J1. So it's a Les Paul style chambered guitar, also with Ron Ellis pickups in there. I don't play that guitar a lot live, but on this record, it was that guitar that we used it once and we were like, hey, that was really surprisingly awesome. Not that we expected it to be bad, but come to another song, we'd be like, none of these guitars are doing it. Grab the Case again. Next song. Ah, nothing else doing it. Grab the Case again. It was one of those guitars that kind of kept having our backs. And then there was a few songs where I used my Sur Strat just for some Strat type sounds, like on Coming Back, Now I See, on the rhythm side. Yeah, those were the main six electrics I used.
Yeah, you were not a much of a vintage guy, are you?
Not particularly. I just, first of all, I can't really afford any nice vintage guitars.
To be clear, you have some really nice guitars, but yeah. Yes.
But like, if I was going to buy a vintage Strat, like I would want like an early 60s, late 50s, like a real deal one, like sure. The kind I go play it when I go to do videos for Carter Vintage or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know what? I've played the cream of the crop. I am so fortunate. I've played like, you know, 59 Les Pauls, Bursts, all, like everything that is like completely heralded. I've gotten to play a lot of them, and I've played some really nice ones. I've played a lot of meh, whatever, average ones too. That kind of doesn't really hit me the same way. The only vintage electric I used to have, I bought a 1975 Les Paul Deluxe Tobacco Burst off of a friend of mine. That was when those Les Paul Deluxes were those ones with the mini humbuckers in it. And it was a cool guitar, but like, you know, I struggled to keep it in tune. I struggled with a lot of things on it. It was just in some ways very temperamental. And I was just thinking in some ways, you know what? I feel like newer guitars are kind of holding up better in some ways. I'm not against taking a vintage guitar out on the road and playing it. Like I took my 64 Deluxe Reverb on the road all the time years ago until I had to retire it just because it was kind of getting the shit kicked out of it. I believe those guitars should be played, but I'm just, yeah, it doesn't hit me the same way that it might for others. If an opportunity landed in front of me saying, hey, friend of mine is selling this early 60s 335, I think you might really dig it, then I might be like, okay, maybe I should sell all my guitars and think about getting that or something. You know what I mean? But sure. I did just get my hands on, at the end of the summer, I was introduced to Ruben at Old Style Guitar Shop.
Oh, yeah.
And I got one of, he sent me this, I bought it, this old 50s K guitar that he transformed into a baritone with the flat wounds and the rubber bridge and the pickup in it.
I think I remember that guitar if he posted on Instagram.
He might have, yep.
Yeah.
And I wish I had it for the for Headway, but it has inspired most of the songs on this, what will be this next record.
Wow.
And has been on a lot of sessions. It's such a interesting and different sound that I love so much. Like I have a couple vintage guitars like that. Like I have an old Tiesco Del Rey and some old kind of junk guitars. I have this old Greco. I was, my father-in-law actually had his first guitar in his basement. He was cleaning out the basement and he's like, hey, my first guitar is here. And he just gave it to me and I had no idea what it was. And Mason Stoops, bless him, did some research for me, and I think it's a Greco.
Sure.
Don't know. It would be a mid-60s or an early 60s. I kind of like the old junky guitars like that. I'm not super... Like, if I stumble upon one or if one lands in my lap and it makes sense to just buy it and take the plunge, great. Otherwise, I'm not necessarily looking for it. Specifically for vintage guitars, the acoustics would be a different thing. Like if I had a chance to, you know, get my hands on an, I mean, it just seems like a pipe dream, but like an old Martin or a pre-war D20. Like I've played Chris Eldridge's his main D28, and the first time I played it, it was like, yeah, this is definitely a different thing. This is definitely the thing. I do get it. So there's that. That's just a whole different world.
It kind of is. I mean, do you also enjoy the back and forth process with these makers and builders, or do you usually just get the guitar after it's been finished from them?
I do enjoy the back and forth. Typically, these are specifically everyone I've mentioned are people that I have relationships with and are friends of mine. And it's the point is it for it to be a collaborative experience, so I can specifically tell them what I'm looking for, and they know what they cater to what I like. It's not usually just like, hey, made this guitar, I think you'd like it, try it out. You know, sometimes it happens, and I'm grateful to get to try a bunch of cool guitars out like that. It just keeps, I love that we live in a time where there's so many builders, and just as creative as music is and the pedal world is, the guitar world is maybe 5 times the size, full of people that are creative and trying stuff out. I really truly come back to the same style of guitar. I'm not looking to ever play anything that's reinventing the wheel. Like I like a Strat style guitar, I like a Tele, I like a 335, I like a Jazzmaster, kind of anything else with a Bigsby or some kind of tremolo on it. Other than that, whatever. You know, I'm not picky, but I know what I like. I'm not looking for anything modern. Even though things are new and being made now, people are really paying attention to what makes those older guitars stand out, just with real supreme quality. And yeah, like I said, it's about the relationships and something about knowing the person that's building your guitar and them knowing what you do and hearing how you sound and listening to your music while they're building. I don't know. There's something really nice about that. And there is something to be said about that extra love and attention going into building an instrument.
Sure. How did you and Matt from Mule cross paths?
Well, I was on tour 5 years ago. I was playing a festival in Denmark called Tuna. It was actually my friend Jay Lapp, plays in a band called The Steel Wheels. They were playing the festival too. And he just kept raving about Mule Resonator. He says, you got to check out this guy, Matt. He makes these resonators. They're really beautiful. I think you'd really dig them. I know you like to play slide. I said, cool. Sounds great. And I still didn't have a chance. Like, I think we started, you know, following each other on Instagram and Facebook. He was also buddies with Joey Landreth, who at the time I was still playing in the Bros. And he had a resonator, and I think he had just, he's like, yeah, Matt's making a Tele style electric or something like that. Oops, sorry about that. And eventually I was talking to Matt. I'm always scheming ideas. I think a lot of guitar players are always scheming things, right?
Sure.
Oh, I got this idea of like putting a this and that. And yeah, Matt and I had started talking a lot more. We had a mutual appreciation for each other. He wanted to do something with me, and I was keen to do something too. And I kept saying, dude, everything you make is amazing. Pardon me. I'm such a Strat guy, though. Would you ever consider doing a Strat-style electric? And he's like, probably not. Like, I'm busy with the resonators. I got the Tele thing going. It's just probably not in the cards right now. I said, okay. He said, but keep bugging me. I said, okay, I'll keep bugging you. Sure enough, you know, another month. Hey, man, are you going to do that Strat? Where are we at with that? Not yet. And I remember I was playing the Winnipeg Jazz Festival. One of my first shows as a solo artist, 2017. Or maybe it was 2018. I don't remember. Anyways, it was like one of my first actual shows as a solo artist in my hometown, and someone filmed some clips, and I posted one of the clips, which is like this little slide thing I do in my show every night. And I posted it, and I remember if you find the post and look down on it, you can actually find his comment. He was like, all right, dude, Did you still want to do the Strat style? I'm so fired up from this that like I have to do it now. So so he did it, and he put it together. I met up with it on tour in Nashville. I was doing videos at Carter Vintage. There it was. Took it out on the gig that night. It was kind of a different experience, just getting to know the timbre of it and how it reacted with feedback and a loud amp. And now it's at a point where it's just another electric guitar. I don't even think about it. But I played that for a few months. And then we finally met. Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. We met. He came to a bros gig in Ann Arbor, Michigan once. And we hung out there. But I went and visited him at the workshop in Saginaw right before my record came out in January 2019. And he's become such a good friend. He's such a lovely guy, music lover, supportive dude, just a good guy. And yeah, that the rest is history. Yeah.
And for folks who haven't visualized this, because, you know, his Telecasters are kind of hollow body and got that bluesy rezzo sound. What did he do to this besides the baritone neck?
I don't think he did anything different. The neck is the same. It's 25 and a half scale length, just like a normal Strat would be, which is a huge part of it because I find that a baritone electric with like 27 to 28 scale length sounds more like a bass because it's just a bit tighter on the strings and it's just got that bassier thing. Whereas normal scale length with the right gauge of string, it still sounds like guitar. Yeah, it sounds low because you're tuning down, but it still sounds like guitar. And I know some people will understand what I mean, some people won't, but it's just what it is. So everything else is the same. Same pickups, same neck. The only thing is the body change. There's no body dip. There's no curvature on the back. It's just like a vintage Tele body, but as a Strat shape, which I like a lot.
Nice. Well, I know we talked about you doing a little video for us. Have you given any thought to what that's going to be?
I have, actually. I was going to do that today.
Nice. What is it? You want to tease us?
Yeah, so I was thinking of showing how to play the main chordal riff of a song called It's You, which is on the record. It's got an interesting tuning and a very interesting pattern of playing that I don't often do and I don't think is often done. So I think it makes for a very interesting sound, and it's something that could be used for your own writing or creativity down the road. I think it'll be a fun lesson to do.
Nice. Where did this pattern come from? When did it hit you?
It hit me. I know exactly when it hit me. I was in Toronto. I was with my wife because she was working in Toronto for a month, and I went to visit. It was actually the month that How Long came out. So, you know, without a pandemic and without quarantining, this is already 2 years ago, but I would go to Toronto for a few days and then go back to Winnipeg, do some press, do a session, go back to Toronto. I was just like going back and forth a lot. I'd always take a guitar and like a tiny little Katana amp so I could play. And I remember just messing around with this hammer-on idea. I was capoed up really high on a guitar, and the tuning is open G, but it's not traditional open G. It's actually open E interval, so like 1-5-1-3-5-1, but in G. And I know this sounds confusing. It's technically open G, but it's not open G like Keith Richards' open G, if you feel me.
Yeah.
And I was capoed up high. I was messing around with. I was capoed up high because the guitar I was playing was in C, so. It'll be lower on the guitar I did listen on is my Callings, which is an open E, so it'll be a little bit lower. But I was just playing around with like these hammer-ons on and off with a little bit of slap delay, and it sounded like guitar, but it also sounded like, what the hell is it? It was just such a different sound to my ear. So I just chased it out until I could come up with a hook, kind of a melody with it that sounded like something I would remember and could sing along to. And then that was the beginning of writing that song, It's You.
I love it. Ariel, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Oh, dude, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.